Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host and producer, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This is episode 53. We call it Arctic Fever. Joining us is Michael Robinson, creator, host, and producer of Time to Eat the Dogs, a weekly podcast about science, history, and exploration. Like Geographical Imaginations, Time to Eat the Dogs broadens scholarly conversations and makes public a range of ideas and thinking. He looks inside and outside his own discipline and brings lots of people to the air, explorers, scientists, anthropologists, literary scholars, and of course historians, all to talk about exploration. Michael's also a professor of history at the University of Hartford in Connecticut. His own research involves the role of exploration in science and culture. His award-winning first book, The Coldest Crucible, Arctic Exploration and American Culture, details the story of Arctic exploration in the United States during the height of its popularity, from 1850 to 1910, something that has become to be known as Arctic Fever. With this conversation, we embark on a series of radio expeditions that will look at the Arctic region from many different angles. One of those angles here is the history of exploration. Tonight, we want to get at how, in the case of Michael's research, everyday Americans came to know the Arctic during the second half of the 19th century and early years of the 20th century, an era charged by this Arctic fever, the excitement in and around the expeditions going to the northern polar region in search of the Northwest Passage, in search of lost expedition parties, and later in search of the North Pole. We talk tonight about these expeditions, the heroes leading them, and how they came back home and communicated this terra incognita to a wide, feverish audience waiting to hear their accounts. Michael Robinson, our guest tonight, in his book, The Coldest Crucible, tells us this. Arctic explorers merit a kind of scrutiny because they were men of consequence in the 19th century. They captured the attention of the nation's scientific and political elite and shaped the ideas and institutions of geography at a time when it dominated American science. Their voyages kindled the fires of the romantic imaginations as settlements overran the American frontier. These explorers served as the muses for generations of writers, including Washington Irving, Edgar Allan Poe, Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Henry David Thoreau, and Jack London. Painters, too, gained inspiration from fur-clad voyagers. Luminous icebergs and lonely ships fill out the scenes of James Hamilton, William Bradford, and the most heralded landscape painter of the era, Frederick Church. Explorers were also the darlings of the world's most powerful publishers, who fell over each other trying to secure rights to their stories. Arctic voyages thrilled and sometimes galled those who read about them in personal narratives, newspapers, school geographies, family atlases, and dime novels. Millions paid admission to see explorers narrate their journeys at public lectures, world fairs, museums, and massive traveling polar panoramas. Those who managed to miss this deluge still had to weather a blizzard of Arcticana, expedition sheet music, fabric patterns, silverware, buttons, playing cards, postcards, and cigar bands that settled into the nation's domestic spaces, cluttering the bureaus, mantelpieces, and piano stands of American homes. So although the Arctic never wore the colors of a U.S. state on 19th century maps, it became a national landscape nevertheless. Its glittering hummocks became the setting of American stories, and its bays and capes, like the men who named them, entered the American vernacular. For us on Geographical Imaginations, we're interested broadly in how, I think one of our main themes is how different regions, different countries, different places enters into our imagination. The Arctic is a really particular place that what started to enter into the American popular imagination in the middle of the 19th century?
Yeah, that's right. So for American audiences, they had been really reading about the Arctic intensely since the early 1800s, when the British Admiralty attempted a number of expeditions to find the Northwest Passage, really starting in 1818. And because the United States was so dependent, really, upon British press for decades, the American audiences were routinely seeing accounts of expeditions that were coming and going by Ross and Perry and other individuals. And that led to a kind of crescendo in 1845 when an expedition under the command of Sir John Franklin left England to try to find the Northwest Passage with two ships, 129 men, and disappeared. And so it was really the disappearance of the Franklin expedition and the kind of gradual alarm that grew in England spread to the United States. And in 1850, Lady Jane Franklin, wife of John Franklin, actually petitioned the American president, Zachary Taylor, and asked for his help in sending an American expedition to find Franklin, which was then subsidized by a private patron, Henry Grinnell, who was basically made his money from shipping and whaling.
Right.
And using this kind of weird amalgam of a naval expedition that was being funded privately, the first Grinnell expedition, a naval expedition, was sent up to the Arctic to try to find Franklin. They didn't find Franklin, but they found graves of Franklin's men from their first winter campsite. And based on that, kind of Arctic fever, so to speak, caught hold in the United States, and the United States really became a player for the next 50 years in the Arctic.
So it's this terra incognita. It's one of the last places on Earth that's been explored. And Franklin goes, and how many years after was it that you're saying that the expedition to search for him went? Was it 5 years?
So Franklin left in 1845, and these expeditions were provisioned to last anywhere from 2 to 4 years. In fact, earlier British expeditions had gotten stuck in the ice. And so no one was very worried even after a couple of years. But by 1848 and 1849, relief expeditions had started out. And by 1850, everyone was quite nervous. So that's when the American expedition left. Yeah.
And so they're going on a mission. I mean, is this, I guess what I'm trying to get at is this Arctic fever, does it start to spread because there's a sense of mission to save people from this faraway land, this unknown territory?
So I think for Americans, there were a couple of things at work. One was that the Arctic by itself was not something that captured the American imagination. I mean, for example, if you go back to the late 1700s, there's almost nothing in the American popular press about the Arctic. They had other things to worry about.
Yeah.
And it was really the West. If there was a landscape that was important, it was the lands west of the Appalachians that were interesting to American audiences. But I think it was the interest of the British, who in the American imagination, certainly let's say the American middle class, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant imagination, it was a place that was important because they could see that the British were not just exploring the Arctic to find a new commercial route, for example, which was the original goal of the Northwest Passage.
Right.
These expeditions were doing something else, and that was they were attempting to show off British power. They were a form of national prestige. And American audiences did know very much about the success of James Cook's voyages to the Pacific in the late 1700s, because American school children were reading about Cook in their geography primers and their family atlases. I mean, this stuff was everywhere. So there was a way in which I think American popular audiences already understood that exploration had changed, and it wasn't simply about commercial exploitation or colonization, that it was a way of showing off what we today might call soft power.
Yeah.
And so the idea that Americans would go into the Arctic and save not just any British expedition, but essentially the cream of the crop, the jewel of the crown, John Franklin and his two ships, was intensely exciting for American audiences. And then attached to that was also all of the kind of aesthetic qualities of the Arctic that had been made popular by the British and other Europeans, this kind of romantic sublime that gets attached to icebergs and the aurora borealis and landscapes right. of the Arctic.
I mean, at this time, are people traveling, maybe not on these full expeditions, but people traveling to the first sort of rings of the polar regions, are they bringing back animals? Is this something that, or it, at the very least, you know, pelts from animals that they've hunted there? Is that something that's being shown in a public, arena?
So yeah, that's an interesting question. And, you know, when I was doing research at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia, must have been 10 years ago, I remember that the curator there brought up an image of a polar bear that was painted for, and I think it was by one of the Peel artists, or it was displayed in the Peel Museum, but it was from right from the beginning of the 1800s. It really didn't look at all like a polar bear, but there was a kind of fascination with these animals in the far north. And there were, you know, to the degree to which people were in the, Europeans were in the high north, it was for fur trading. I mean, people were looking for pelts. So there definitely was an interest. And there was also increasingly the presence of whalers in Baffin Bay and in the high Pacific. So yeah, there was an interest in the kind of natural history of the Arctic.
And that would have been circulating at that time. And so it's not a completely unknown space or unknown region. It's slowly starting to enter into people's thinking.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair. Although I think it was pretty spectacular. Yeah, I think it was a pretty spectacular increase with the disappearance of the Franklin expedition.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. The term expedition, I mean, you just mentioned, I think it's interesting. Sometimes I just go back and look how a dictionary still defines a word.
Yeah.
And dictionary does, you know, it says a journey or voyage, this is from Oxford, undertaken by a group of people with a particular purpose, especially that of exploration, scientific research, or war.
Yeah.
I mean, is that, this falls in maybe to a little bit of a different category? Is this, you're saying soft power, it's spreading sort of the, it's not so much empire, you're not colonizing and trying to take over the peoples, but it's also putting a flag on the North Pole, not yet, but later in this era that you're studied, it's about kind of making some claim to the region.
Yeah, so that's interesting, the definition you gave, because when I first started wading into the indexes for expeditions in the 1600s and 1700s, when I was writing Coldest Crucible, expedition was attached to military endeavors. almost exclusively. And I found that really interesting because I didn't know that. I had never grown up thinking about expeditions as military things, but that was the original meaning that I found when I went to the indexes. And that begins to change in the 1700s. And I think that the change is interesting because a lot of those 18th century voyages by James Cook or by others, by Malaspina or Bougainville or La Perouse, they were national expeditions and often involved naval forces. So yeah. I wonder in a way whether the meaning of expedition migrated from a military context, because these were naval expeditions, to the meaning we now think of them as kind of discovery expeditions in the early 19th century.
Yeah.
But yeah, to the point of your question, expedition sounds very official. And I think in a way that's the goal of calling it an expedition is giving it some symbolic heft, because, you know, what's the difference between somebody who travels and somebody who explores? I mean, I don't really think there is much of one. Or to call somebody an explorer versus a traveler, in many respects, the difference is not a difference of kind or of content. It's the difference of who's going out exploring. It's the identity of the person going out. So for example, you do not often hear of people from, let's say, the Swahili coast who are moving into Central Africa in the 1700s as explorers, but they were. Or you don't hear about, let's say, Africans who are crossing the Sahara as part of the Trans-Sahara trade as explorers, but they were doing relatively the same thing that, you know, Western pioneers were doing as they moved west. So I think in a way, expedition is a term that gives symbolic heft to the object of travel. It's not that it's really different in kind.
Right. Yeah. So do we relate explorer to a certain age of transatlantic exploration of, in the, you know, the Spanish, Portuguese, the British, going out and by ship exploring the world. And so have we had to get away from that term? Is that part of it, or
I wrestle with this a lot. I wrestle with this a lot because I feel that, you know, as I was saying before, I think that, you know, people travel for a variety of reasons. They travel because they want to learn more about the world, or they want to learn more about themselves. And those motives, or they want to make money. And those motives, often mixed motives, are true for people around the world, you know, Western, non-Western. And so then the question becomes, what value do we give to this term exploration or expedition when they are really freighted? I think they're really freighted as Western terms. I wrestle with this question a lot. And I think my only answer is to say, I guess it depends upon the project. If you're interested in looking at a specific cultural context, that is North America and Europe in the period from, you know, 1400 to the present, then the word expedition is perfectly acceptable, and you can talk about it in that context. But if you want to dig at cross-cultural projects or how other people travel, which is kind of the goal of my podcast, actually, is to try to bring those things into conversation.
Yeah.
Then expedition isn't really a very useful term because it is so freighted. I will just say very briefly that there have been people who've tried to kind of categorize this stuff. William Getzmann in the late 60s wrote about there being three ages of exploration, or at least two ages. And then I think Stephen Pine kind of expanded upon that with three ages of exploration, the first of which, all of them are very Eurocentric, but the first of which was, you know, essentially from Columbus or from the 1400s forward, where it's, you know, sometimes typified as the first age of discovery, where you have people going out to create missions and, you know, get gold and to colonize people. And then you had the second age of exploration, which was the Enlightenment period, where you guys have guys like Cook and Lewis and Clark and these kind of manifestly scientific expeditions. And then the third age, which Stephen Pine talks about, is the 20th century, which he would argue is a kind of the exploration of places without people in them, almost abiotic expeditions undersea to the Antarctic, into space. Although I believe that that's actually a not very good way of describing 20th century exploration, but that's kind of a potted history of the idea of exploration, I guess.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program, or radio essay expedition, that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
I guess going off that a little bit, this idea of the difference of travel and exploration, is, and to bring the term expedition maybe back in there, is, can we say the beginning and the end of an expedition are not when the people, whoever's going on it, in this case, a marine one, a seabound one, it's not when they get board the ship and then disembark it is when it ends. It's much larger than that. And I guess what I'm getting at is the amount of work that goes into preparing for, and let's go back to this, you know, 1850, more or less, expeditions to the Arctic. It doesn't start when you get on the ship. It starts much earlier than that. There's a lot of planning, fundraising. There's putting together a team. And then it doesn't end when you come back from it, because there's a lot of, you know, the continual cycle, like, or the continuation of the cycle of fundraising and then making it public. Can you walk us through maybe this ideal of the expedition from this era and how it started and how it ended? In these terms, maybe? Yeah.
Well, one of the great things for me working on this field now is how much it's changed since when I started. There were very few texts that were looking at expeditions beyond, let's say, the ship leaving the dock and the return, focusing a lot on the voyage and not a lot on these other things. And boy, the field is so interesting now. People are looking at all kinds of different contexts from, you know, certainly let's say in the 70s and 80s, the idea of exploration changed a lot with the kind of social science revolution brought by Michel Foucault and Edward Said and people beginning to say, well, you know, these are not voyages in a vacuum. How do these affect, you know, indigenous peoples, local peoples? So that certainly changed the way these stories were written. And then the things that you were talking about, like, well, what about the conception of these voyages and the return and the popular reception of them? I'm thinking a really important book for me was Bo Rifenberg's book, The Myth of the Explorer, which I think came out in the early 90s and really talked a lot about the popular reception of exploration. So what's the value of exploration to people back home? And that really shaped my interests, I think, in the Arctic. And now, you know, you have this new generation of scholarship and scholars who are looking not only at, let's say, exploration as a place of encounter between explorers and local peoples, and also receptions, but also looking at materials. So Sarah Pickman, for example, at Yale, who I had on the podcast a few months ago, she was talking about reading a number of books for her PhD exams and saying that one of the trends that she noticed was how much of a focus there is on the materiality of exploration, you know, which for me is really cool. It's like an area in which, oh, now we get to dig into that and see how that shapes this story that we keep telling, you know. So
right. How would a team be picked? How would the personnel be picked on an expedition?
So it depends a lot on the context, but for example, in the Arctic, you had a number of voyages where the team would be selected by the commander, let's say, and I'll use the Arctic as the context since I know it the best, but because the Arctic became increasingly popular in the late 19th century, sometimes you would have hundreds and hundreds of applicants for expeditions. For example, Robert Peary, who led, I believe, 8 expeditions into the Arctic and finally towards the North Pole in an attempt to reach it first. His archives are filled with literally hundreds of letters of application from people around the country who wanted to join his expedition. And he would make these decisions, you know, himself or with a couple of other people. There are certainly changes in that. I mean, as you move into the 20th century and people start doing social science research and they start really investigating, let's say, small group cohesion and asking the question, you know, what kind of personalities fit together well, those decisions about crews change a lot. And I was actually just listening to interviews and oral history with Philip Law, who is the director of the Australian Antarctic Division.
All right.
And he was talking about, this is an interview that he did when he had retired, I think in 1987. And he was talking about how originally they tried to pick like go-getters and big personalities for their Antarctic stations and found that that actually led to a lot of problems and that you had far better luck finding people who were actually a little bit more reserved and who were a bit more flexible and who did not have big opinions about everything. And that those qualities actually also changed over time. As you developed a base and the base matured, you would need different kind of selection devices for your crew.
Yeah. So not necessarily the, maybe the recruitment of those popular people was to help get funding. Is that part of?
I'm sure it did. I'm sure on certain expeditions. I mean, you know, money was always an issue. Although it didn't show up as much into who you selected for your crewmates because those people might very well die. But it was how you decided to name various things that you found, various capes, bays, mountains, which you would, you know, name after your patrons so that they would be proud of all of the money they gave you.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that is part of the, I don't know, one of the legacies of the of this expedition, this Arctic fever era, are the toponyms, the place names that have there. Are there any that you could think of off the top of your head that are funders from the Arctic?
The first name that comes to mind is Crocker Land, which was supposedly an island that Peary found on his way back from an Arctic voyage. Attempts were made to find this island off in the distance, and no one ever found it, but it was named after a patron, big patron of his expedition. So it was clear that he wanted to name this, after someone who had given him a lot of money. And, the bays and capes of the Arctic are filled with the names of patrons.
And so coming back from one of their expeditions, they would immediately contact some cartographic authority to get that placed there. Is that how that would work?
That's a good question. Yeah. I don't know the actual root of this information, whether it was people at the Coast Survey, for example, reading the narratives of explorers, or certainly were the explorers actually writing the names on the capes and bays and then submitting it for, I'm not actually sure of that process.
Yeah, because it's internet. I mean, the Arctic, for instance, is shared by 8 or 9 different countries, right? It's while there are some probably very clear boundaries, I wonder in the mid 19th century if those boundaries were as clear as they are today.
I know there was a big fight over the naming of what today is called Ellesmere Island, which the Americans wanted to name Grinnell Land after, Henry Grinnell, who had funded the first Grinnell expedition to find Franklin. And it became Ellesmere Island, which I believe is a British name, although I'm not 100% sure of that. But I do remember that Americans were quite annoyed by that. And I think they also called a part of it Grant Land as well.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
Was it officially called the Grinnell Expedition? Is that?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Who was leading that? Is this Elisha Kane? Or is he a member of that first expedition?
Yes, he was a member of it. It was actually led by a naval officer, Edwin De Haven, who was happy to lead the voyage, but didn't want to write about the voyage, didn't see himself as a writer. So that normal prerogative of the commander to write the narrative of the expedition was delegated to Kane, who was the medical officer. Elisha Kane had been educated at University of Pennsylvania, was a physician. He had also served in the Mexican-American War. He had traveled around the world and enlisted to join this Grinnell expedition when it left. And when the opportunity was given to him to be the chronicler of this expedition, he took that up with zeal. And his narrative of the first Grinnell expedition became quite a hit. And especially when he came back and wanted to lead his own expedition, the fact that he was actually writing about the first expedition increased his stature. Plus, he knew how to write. I mean, he wrote in that kind of Emersonian romantic style that was quite in vogue in the United States in the years before the Civil War. So it sounds quite melodramatic today. It's really quite over the top, but it was these kind of majestic, spectacular scenes of Arctic icebergs and wildlife.
Making connections to the classics or to
mythology.
Of Western civilization and
allusions to Odysseus and lots of that.
So the men then on this expedition are mythological in some ways. They rise above. They're being talked about back home as these really big figures, maybe bigger than I don't want to make a comparison to today, but I mean, our heroes today are in sports and I don't know, I guess in popular imagination, sports are figures are heroes, actors are heroes in some ways. Were they of this sort of stature?
They became of that stature because it's interesting. There's this shift. The first Grinnell expedition, when it's sent up, I think because this was really new, first of all, the American Congress and the American press didn't exactly know what to do with it, but they liked the idea of an American expedition finding the British. So there was a kind of patriotic fervor around it, but it wasn't a fervor that was attached to De Haven or any individual on the expedition, none of whom were known in 1850.
Yeah.
But the kind of cult of personality around explorers really grew up with Elisha Kane. I mean, he was the Neil Armstrong of the 1850s.
Okay,
I mean,
so that's died. A better, right.
Yeah, when he died, I mean, so he led his own expedition in 1853 and returned, got stuck in Smith Sound, overwintering in the ice, eventually was able to lead his men out on whaleboats. It's kind of like a kind of precursor to the Shackleton expedition.
Yeah.
Managed to get everybody out alive except for three men. I think he lost three men. And when he returned in 1855, everyone thought he was dead. So it was met with astonishment and glee. And then Kane himself became quite a hero for leading his men out of danger, as well as for writing about it so eloquently. And then Kane himself died of rheumatic fever in 1857, which only catapulted his reputation even higher. So he had a funeral cortege that lasted for 3 weeks. It was the biggest funeral cortege, I believe, until Abraham Lincoln in 1865. So
didn't they sail up the Mississippi, or they traveled the Mississippi?
And they went by train.
He died in Cuba at 37 years old, right? At 37, dies in Cuba because he went there thinking that was going to be better for his health.
That's right.
And then sails up the Mississippi with stops so that people could pay their respects, right?
That's right. Thousands of people showed up in Columbus and in Baltimore. Ultimately, he was laid to rest in Philadelphia, but there's an entire book published just about the funeral cortege for Elisha Kane. It's called Obsequies of Dr. Kane. And it's hundreds of pages of eulogies and descriptions of the passage of his body from Cuba to its final resting place in Philadelphia. It's unbelievable.
And the Geographic Society of Philadelphia honors someone maybe every decade with a medal in his name. I mean, it's that popular. Although if I asked social studies students in eighth grade, maybe if they had heard of him, what are most US American social studies students in eighth grade going to say?
Yeah, no one, you know, I don't think anybody knows about Kane. It's really interesting, the afterlife of explorers, because it's hard to predict, actually. I mean, Lewis and Clark, for example, who every middle school kid knows about, were relatively unknown in the 19th century. They were only really rediscovered after the centennial exposition for Lewis and Clark in 1905. That put them back on the map because so much about Lewis and Clark had been lost.
Right.
You know, their materials had been lost. They were eclipsed by other explorers. I mean, they just really weren't known about. And yet in the 20th century, they've become huge figures. Whereas people like Elisha Kane or Alexander von Humboldt are really not talked about very much in popular culture. You know, it's the same with Shackleton. I mean, Shackleton
until the film was made. Or the book came out first. But yeah,
you know, Robert Falcon Scott was the great martyr of Antarctic exploration. He died, you know, at a time when Britain was gearing up for the First World War, and it was all of a piece, right? Somebody who gave his life for the British patriotism. Yeah. And Shackleton, by contrast, was a guy who, you know, never even made it to the Antarctic mainland. His ship was crushed and he came back, you know, with his crew. So it was really only in the 1960s that Scott kind of disappears or becomes looked at differently. And then Shackleton rises. So it's really interesting the way these things, you know, these afterlives of explorers.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
To continue with Kane, for instance, you know, his popularity, I think writing a book is really important, and that gives him a platform. But did he also use the, you know, was he also giving speeches and giving presentations in cities that he visited? My assumption is it's because he's raising funds to pay off debts or to pay for the next expedition, but also is he just engaged in that public forum of bringing the world home?
Yes, he was. And he gave dozens and dozens of lectures between the first Grinnell expedition and the second Grinnell expedition that he led. And he lectured widely, especially on the East Coast. And there are also accounts of his expeditions in the newspapers. And from those, we know that interest in exploration was not limited to people like Kane. It was broadly popular with working class and middle class audiences, with men and women. I mean, the writings of women about Kane are quite incredible. People who see him as a model of manliness, or who are taken with his writings, his evocative romantic writings, his gothic writings. In fact, kind of the point of my first book, Coldest Crucible, is to look at the Arctic not as a place in and of itself, but as a kind of stage for Americans to talk about things that they think are really important. One of which is, what does it mean to be a man in the 19th century? What does it mean to be a man of character? And how that idea changes from Elisha Kane, who was, you know, he was short. He was suffering from rheumatic fever from the age of 19. He spoke in a kind of dreamy, gothic way about life in the Arctic, who was described by his men as motherly or feminine in his qualities. And yet all of those things together combine to make him an icon of manliness. Whereas at the end of the 19th century, when you look at a guy like Robert Peary, who was also praised by dozens and dozens of women, again, his archives are filled with postcards and letters from fans, women fans, often describe him as a man in very different terms, as being strong, as being brave, as being a man of few words, of being tough. It's a very different model of what it means to be a man. And I think you see it in the way that they're described by their, you know, their followers.
So a complete public persona is being developed through their own writings, the writings of others, newspapers. There's complete, I mean, mid-19th century, we have wide distribution of all of these, all this reading material, so to speak. So people are plugged in. They're following their lives in some ways. They do take on this, I don't know, the superstar persona.
Yes, and also it becomes a persona that they can't control entirely, right? Because the press of the 1850s may not have been a celebrity press in the way that we, you know, think about, you know, TMZ or, you know, other People right. magazine, you know, today, but it was nevertheless a kind of booster press, a press that yeah. was interested in showing the good side, whereas the press of the late 19th century was a press that was perfectly willing to make heroes out of explorers and knew that this could actually help promote circulation to do that, but was also perfectly willing to throw explorers under the bus if the controversies about their lives sold more newspapers. So you had individuals like Kane, who almost was inoculated from some of the controversies around his expedition because papers wouldn't talk about it. But by the late 19th century, explorers are often making deals with newspapers to fund their expeditions.
Yeah.
And when these expeditions go wrong, oftentimes newspapers, certainly rival newspapers, would attack them mercilessly for flaws in leadership or flaws in character. So you see spectacular controversies about these expeditions by Peary, by Adolphus Greely, by others, which are really the product of this new media environment.
And so does this lead to, you know, your book is really looking at between 1850 and 1910, and then there's a fall off probably because of other things happening in the world, but a whole range of different things that lead us to maybe lose Arctic fever, so to speak. Is the media and the increased involvement in the media and shaping the narrative about Arctic exploration, is that part of why it falls sort of away?
I think it's why Arctic explorers become tarnished figures in the eyes of the American public. I mean, by 1910, when you have this huge controversy between Robert Peary and Frederick Cook over who stepped on the North Pole first.
Oh, right.
By the time 1910, you know, passes, people are so sick of this story and they think in so poor esteem of these two individuals because they've fallen so far from this kind of model of patriotic or manly behavior that, you know, it's still a story in the news, but it's people are no longer talking about Arctic explorers as men of character.
Yeah.
And so I think the public retains a fascination with exploration. I don't think that goes away. And I don't think the press leaves it alone either, because you can find really at the end of the Arctic quest, so to speak, really the beginning of the Antarctic quest. I mean, the Antarctic becomes a huge area of interest, as well as other projects, for example, anthropological projects,
right.
Exploration of Papua New Guinea and Africa, and the works of Margaret Mead and Lewis and Maeve Leakey, and, you know, and then of course the space race and, you know, attempts to go underwater. So, I mean, I think there's a thirst among the public for these stories,
yeah.
But I think that there's no longer a protected space in the way that there was in the middle decades of the 19th century.
So I want to thank Michael Robinson for joining us from Hartford. Thank you, Michael.
Kevin, thank you so much. It was really, really fun to talk to you.
Great. Thanks. So here we are at the end of another radio expedition into the geographies of everything and nothing. This was episode 53. We called it Arctic Fever. We were in conversation with Michael Robinson. Check out his work. The book, The Coldest Crucible, was a main theme of tonight's conversation. But also, check out his podcast about science, history, and exploration. He calls it Time to Eat the Dogs. You could find that work on his website, timetoeatthedogs.com. Thanks to Mike Allen as well for use of his song Sand Dune, which you hear right now, and back in the intro and during the different show IDs throughout the episode. Thanks to Mike. We want to remind you this tonight's episode was just the gateway to the Arctic. Thinking about it historically, we have episodes in production right now looking at the polar bear, both in the media and in its own habitat. We have an episode about safety in the Arctic, going there as a researcher or a tourist or in tourism. We are also planning an episode that looks at the untold stories, the individual stories of people living in the Arctic. We believe there's over 4 million people living in the Arctic. I think that statistic tends to surprise a lot of people. Anyways, this is our attempt at the show to unpack a little bit and try to imagine a different Arctic, maybe one that's a little bit informed by different stories and different voices. So stay with us over the course of the next few months as we go up to the north. Thanks. Talk to you soon. Bye.